Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Jeff Dean to the broadcast. Jeff is a Google Senior Fellow, currently leading Google Brain, the search giant's initiative to build large-scale artificial neural networks. Jeff also leads the development of TensorFlow, Google's open-source library of machine learning algorithms. Jeff joined Google in 1999 and had a leading role in building much of the core technology and infrastructure of the company since. Jeff earned his PhD in computer science from the University of Washington and graduated summa cum laude from the University of Minnesota, where he studied computer science and economics, earning his bachelor's degree. In 2009, Jeff was elected to the National Academy of Engineering and was also named a Fellow of the Association for Computing Machinery and a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences. I recently caught up with Jeff by phone in his office in Mountain View, California. Our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed how Google continues to attract, retain, and train top engineering talent. Principle 3, project and portfolio management, as we discussed Google's process for productizing its AI research and bringing it to market. And Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as we discussed how Jeff determines who to interact with inside and outside of the company. We also discussed Google's vision for the transition from the mobile-first world to an AI-first world, and how Jeff and the Google Brain team are building the infrastructure to bring this vision to life, among other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Jeff Dean, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to have you. You've been with Google for most of its history, having joined the company in 1999. And I'd love to understand across the 17 years since, if you could offer at least a brief depiction of the evolution of your roles across the company.
Sure. When I joined, the company was quite small. We were all wedged in a small office on University Avenue in Palo Alto. And kind of the first main things I worked on where I built kind of one of our first advertising systems with a couple other people. And then I spent several years working on the crawling, indexing, and search systems that were used on every query at Google with, you know, probably a varying collection of people over the years. But I probably spent 4 or 5 years on that. And then I spent a fair amount of time mostly working with my colleague, Sanjay Gimawat, and other people on building kind of the software infrastructure that Google uses to store lots of data and to be able to process large data sets and do things like build search indices or process satellite imagery or things like that. And then more recently, I've been working on machine learning systems.
Excellent. Gosh, it's quite a number of roles across the organization reflecting the many avenues that the company has gotten into since you joined when it was, as you mentioned, a very small company. Given how broad your purview is and how expansive your role is, also just the number of places that you've played, I can only imagine you don't have kind of an average day. How do you manage your time? How do you determine who to interact with when, inside, outside of the company? I'd be interested just to know a little bit about kind of how you spend your time on the different things that you're working on at present.
Yeah, it's scattered. Like there is no typical day, I guess. For the first 14 or 15 years I was here, I didn't take on any management roles. So that gave me a lot more free time to kind of just focus and write code. The last couple of years, I've taken on a management role of some of the machine learning efforts, which has been an interesting and new learning experience for me. But, you know, since I've worked on a lot of things over the history of the company, and I tend to like to stay in touch with what's going on those different projects, I tend to get a lot of email because I remain on the mailing list for all the different things I've worked on. So I spend a fair amount of my time dealing with email, mostly deleting it or just skimming it to kind of get a sense of what's going on. And then I'll have a few technical projects that I'm working on at any given time and figure out how to spend my day there, interspersed with various meetings or, you know, design review kind of things.
As somebody, Jeff, who's been with the company since the very early days and seen it grow from a small startup to the behemoth that it currently is, it remains a paragon of innovation, despite the dramatic growth. It remains ambitious and innovative like it was when it was a smaller organization. But of course, now it has the resources, both human and financial, of a behemoth within the tech space. How does the organization fight stasis and bureaucracy so that it can remain much nimbler than its size would suggest?
Since I've been here, I've basically experienced constant growth in the company. And everyone who's been here a long time has experienced that. You know, for the early years, we were actually doubling the number of employees in the company every year. We slowed that down a fair amount in percentage terms, but in absolute terms, we're still growing quite substantially. You know, I forget the exact numbers, maybe 10, 20% per year in number of employees. And I think the interesting thing is, like, basically every doubling in company size causes us to kind of have to rethink how certain things are done within the company. Things that used to work at size X no longer work at size 2X. And we have to kind of figure out how to adapt our style and our engineering organizational structures and team dynamics and so on to adapt to that new size. One of the things that I think has helped us in growing is that we've tended to branch out into a bunch of different areas that are, a lot of them are somewhat independent from the rest of what Google is working on. Building high altitude balloons for internet access has relatively modest interaction with serving search queries. So we can get scale and efficiency that way by essentially just having many different sort of active projects that don't require as much communication as they might if they were in our core business.
And obviously, I guess the separation, the sort of Google Alphabet separation is part of the logic of trying to maintain some of that nimbleness and separating out different kinds of activities. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that allows some of those other entities under Alphabet to operate a little bit more independently. Some of them may want to have slightly different kind of hiring processes or whatever, and that kind of allows them to do that under the Alphabet umbrella. One thing I would say about the doubling in size is, like, there were a few interesting transitions where we went from, you know, everyone being in one building to everyone being now not in one building, and that was kind of an interesting transition. And then going from having engineering members just in Mountain View and then opening offices in a few other cities around the world. For a while, we were picking, like, only the world's highest priced real estate places to open new offices. So we started new offices in Zurich and New York and Tokyo and Seattle. And so we kind of had five offices for a while, and those got fairly big and developed. And then we went through this period of going from like 5 to 35 engineering offices in a few years, because we felt like it would be good to have lots of offices around the world where we could find talented people and start an office around them or around a small team. And that actually caused us to have to rethink how we organized a lot of our engineering efforts, just because if you have a small office, they probably shouldn't work on 100 things. They should work on a few things and focus on them and do them really well. And the model that some of the small offices adopted was to look at what people in Mountain View were doing and seeing that they were working on 100 things, so they figured they should too. And so we meandered our way to a better way of utilizing all the people that we have in all these distributed engineering offices.
Very interesting. Google CEO Sundar Pichai has said that in the long run, devices will fade away and computing will evolve from mobile first to AI first. And I'd be curious, your own, as somebody who's obviously spent a lot of time, as you mentioned, in machine learning and artificial intelligence, how would you express Google's vision of an AI first world?
Well, I do think that, you know, we've moved from desktop computing to mobile computing, where everyone has a phone with them at all times. But as devices continue to shrink and voice recognition and other kinds of alternative user interfaces to just screens become more practical, that's going to actually change how how we interact with computing devices. You know, they may kind of fade into the background and just be around, and we can talk to them just as we would some other trusted companion and have them assist us in getting information we want or accomplishing various tasks. So, you know, I think that's one of the main goals of pushing forward in machine learning is to essentially have computers be able to really provide, you know, kind of the wisdom of someone like what a human companion would be able to provide in offering advice and looking up more information when necessary and those kinds of things. And I think it's going to be pretty exciting times in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. It's going to be great.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's been fascinating just diving into this topic and speaking with a number of your fellow luminaries in the space, as it always seems like AI is in the future tense. And what I mean by that, it seems as though as progress is made, as varying goals for AI are accomplished, it seems like some people no longer speak about it as true AI. That is, those things that have already been accomplished. It always is sort of like in the future tense, I've found, as people describe these things. I don't know if that's your own perspective on this, but how would you kind of define the boundaries, the extent to which there is an easy way to do so, of artificial intelligence?
Right. I mean, I think true artificial general intelligence would be a system that kind of is able to perform human-level reasoning and understanding and accomplishing of sort of very complicated tasks. And we're clearly not there yet. But you're right that there has been a lot of progress in the last few years on things that have traditionally been thought of as, wow, those are actually pretty difficult AI-like tasks. 5 years ago, there was no way a computer could take an image and then generate a human-level sentence that describes that image. And now we actually have machine learning systems that can do a pretty serviceable job of that. It's not quite human-level. You know, it might not have the sophistication of a human. It might say, that's a picture of a man holding a tennis racket on a tennis court. But that's a computer-generated sentence. Whereas a human might say, you know, that's a picture of a tennis player about to serve the ball, which is a little bit more subtle. But still, the fact that computers can now generate these kinds of captions that seem like actually almost human written is a pretty big advance, I think. And that's just one example of things that have improved over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years as people have applied some of these more sophisticated machine learning models, have been able to apply them using larger data sets, more computation. You know, the results have just tended to get better and better.
How far do you suppose we are from artificial general intelligence?
I mean, there's a broad range of estimates, depending on who you ask. I will not hazard anything other than a broad guess, which is I think we are 15 to 50 years away.
I see.
Probably closer to the lower end of that range, but
I see.
I will not hazard a further detailed guess.
No, makes sense. It's good to get your perspective, even if it's a window. As you mentioned, language is really one of the keys, and a lot of Google's AI initiatives are centered around being able to sort of read and understand everything on the web, to engage intelligently in conversation and understand context. Can you talk a little bit more about sort of the path towards having machines being able to interpret better and better, what the sort of stair steps to getting closer to, if not fully accomplishing artificial general intelligence, what some of the stair steps that you foresee and some of the things you're working on?
Sure. So, I mean, I think one of the interesting things is the field of information retrieval, which was very fundamental to the work that Google did in its very early days and still does, traditionally hasn't really tried to truly understand what a user wants when they type in a query. It's been more about like looking for documents that contain the words in the query and perhaps are, you know, in close proximity to each other, but it's largely very brittle in some ways, right? Like you don't really understand the essence of the word car. You just look for the word car. And the interesting thing is in the last 4 or 5 years, we've been able to start to develop techniques that really are better at understanding the essence of the word car, right? Like the fact that car and cars, you know, stemming has existed in information retrieval systems. So that's not so hard. They already kind of dealt with that. But knowing that car and cars and automobile and passenger car and pickup truck are all kind of related in some way, and being able to match documents in this kind of smoother way actually leads to better results in a lot of language understanding tasks. And it's not just words we're able to kind of understand, but we're actually now getting to the point where we can understand that two sentences that are paraphrases of each other are actually mean the same thing in some sense. And that's starting to get to a level of language understanding where we'll be able to push on that and get to the point where we can then understand much longer sequences of text in this kind of more machine learned way. And like a good goal that we have for the next few years is we'd like to be able to take in, you know, hundreds or thousands of documents and then have a dialogue about the contents of those documents or perhaps summarize them or, you know, answer questions or ask questions about the contents of the documents and understand if the user is correct in those responses. I think that's the kind of level of understanding we'll need in order to truly demonstrate very high levels of language understanding.
And it seems like some of the progress that you and your team have made are already starting to see their way into a variety of Google products, like Google Assistant, which is now a conversational virtual assistant, as a big update to Google Now, incorporating some of the same into like Google Home, your answer to the Amazon Echo, for instance, the Allo, the Messenger app that's involved with Google services, also has sort of a conversational interface. So it sounds like, and it seems like there's been some recent progress made that's led to some fundamental changes and even introductions to new offerings within Google. I'd be curious in your own perspectives on some of these recent announcements.
Sure. So the research group that I'm leading at the moment is called Google Brain. Our focus is on building both large-scale computing systems to do machine learning and on doing advanced machine learning research. And the combination of people that have those two different kinds of skills coming together to work on problems often leads to significant advances that people with just machine learning skills or people with just large-scale computer system skills often couldn't achieve on their own. So I think that's one of the reasons, you know, our group has had a fair amount of success in trying to both push the state-of-the-art in machine learning research, but also push the state-of-the-art in how much computation can we throw at these problems and can we train really large, powerful models on problems we actually care about. And then we've been fairly opportunistic in doing long-term research, but also understanding when some of our research results can actually be used to improve Google products today. And that improvement can sometimes happen from improving a feature that the product already has, or sometimes it can come from a new capability that you really couldn't do before, suddenly enabling a bunch of new features and products, or perhaps even new whole products. And so we then work with product teams to say, hey, we think this machine learning research that we've done would be really useful in this context in your product. And sometimes that's a fairly hands-off thing. We'll just kind of point them at what we've done and say, hey, we think you should try this. Sometimes it'll be a very deep collaboration between people in our group and the product teams to actually make that research sort of become real in a real product. A few examples of this are some of the work that researchers in our group did. Ilya Slutskever, Oriol Vignol, and Kwok Lee developed a model called sequence-to-sequence learning. The idea being that you want to take in an input sequence and then use that input sequence to then try to predict some output sequence. That sounds very abstract, but it turns out that particular framing of a problem can be mapped onto lots of real problems that you care about solving. The work they did in the research paper that they published was originally done in the context of doing language translation. So the input sequence might be a sequence of English words, one word at a time, and then you hit a special end of English token, and the model is trained to then spit out the equivalent French sentence, one word at a time, that means the same thing as that English sentence. And this is a bit unlike other machine translation systems, which often are much more logical code and lots of kind of sub pieces of the problem, perhaps using machine learning or statistical models, and then a bunch of GUI code to stitch this all together. And in contrast to that approach, this is just a completely machine learned end-to-end system where you feed in pairs of sentences that mean the same thing in different languages, and the system learns to translate one language to another. That general model was actually quite useful in a bunch of other contexts. So the Gmail team adopted it and used it as the basis for a feature that we call Smart Reply, where now the input sequence is an incoming email to you, and the generated sequence is predictions of replies you might want to give to that email, given the context of that incoming email. So as an example, you know, you might get an email saying, hey, we'd love to invite you over for Thanksgiving dinner, and please let us know if you can make it. And the replies that might get generated would be, you know, yeah, we'd love to, what can we bring? Or, sorry, we can't make it, or similar things that are sort of contextually relevant. And the nice thing is that same underlying model, just kind of trained on different data sets.
Yeah, that's so interesting, Jeff. I'm curious, as you just described that, like research that is done and breakthroughs that are happening in one part of the company, and then sort of thinking about the application of those new ideas across Google's more traditional product offerings, how does that dissemination or even investigation of the potential applications of what's happening in your part of the organization, in the Google Brain organization, how do you interact with your colleagues to investigate or to determine all the different potential applications of the work that you're doing? It sounds as though there's work done in a specific area and then some surprising conclusions as to the broad set of potential value that can be derived from it.
We kind of have started to formalize this process a bit. I mean, when we first started doing work in this area about 5 years ago, when we started our machine learning research group to investigate the use of, you know, large amounts of computation and kind of use of deep neural networks to tackle different kinds of problems, there weren't very many people in the company using these kinds of approaches. And we found a few places that we felt like they could be effective, including one of the first was in the speech recognition system. So we worked very closely with people in our speech recognition team to actually deploy deep neural networks as part of the speech recognition system and got very substantial improvements in the recognition accuracy of that system. And then we did a bunch of work with various computer vision related teams, so image search and some of the street view teams, to actually train models to do interesting things given the raw pixels of various images, extracting text from images or understanding what is in an image. Is it a leopard or a garbage truck or whatever? And the interesting thing is, over time, more and more teams started to adopt these approaches because they would hear from another team that they were trying this thing and getting good results. And so either we would put them in contact with these other teams, or we would sort of provide some basic advice about how they could go about it, approaching it in their particular problem context. And then we formalized that a bit. So we now have a team that does a bit of outreach and is a first point of contact for teams who are trying to use these kinds of machine learning models in their products. So they'll kind of describe the problem, and that team will say, oh, that sounds a lot like this other team's problem where this solution worked well. Why don't you go try that and then report back to see what happened. And we've had this very large exponential increase in the number of teams, the number of people using these kinds of approaches, going from like a handful of teams in 2011 and 12 to now we probably have 200 teams using these kinds of things, with, you know, thousands of people who have trained models of this kind using the software that our team has built.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You're also one of the main creators of TensorFlow, Google's open source machine learning library, which you've alluded to. Google, likes several other companies, has been focused on developing open source AI technology. And I'm curious what your own perspective on open source is, the rationale in doing it, the advantages of doing so, and so on.
You know, there are actually quite a number of different frameworks for expressing different kinds of machine learning algorithms out there that are open source projects. And I think it's actually good to have, you know, more choice in there, but it's also good if we can produce something that many people in the machine learning community can get behind and work to improve, because a lot of these things are trying to do similar sorts of tasks, And it's nice if we can put together a library that many people will adopt and use. And the reason for that is that, first of all, it'll make it easier to express machine learning ideas. You know, the traditional way is people write a paper about an idea that they've explored, and they do some experiments, and often they don't sort of publish the code that would allow people to reproduce those experiments. So you're, as a researcher, you're looking at someone else's paper and you're trying to compare your technique to the thing that that other person did, and you have to re-implement what that other person did. And often, because it's described in a paper but not in code, you're trying to make guesses about exactly what they did, because papers by their nature leave out a lot of details. Not intentionally, it's just like they might say something like, we used a low learning rate. And really, like, what you care about is that we used a learning rate of 0.001 and then lowered it after 10,000 steps to 0.0005. And so having a software framework where people can express machine learning ideas in code actually allows people to publish those research models and research ideas in an executable form that other people can then try out and experiment and extend in a way that it makes ideas flow around much more rapidly in the community. And I think that's a healthy thing for the machine learning community in general. For us, it also makes it easier for collaborations with people outside of Google. So often we have interns come for the summer, and, you know, in the past they've mostly finished their intern project, but they're still kind of writing up a paper, a research paper about the work that they've done. And then they leave Google and they can't access Google's computers anymore. So that makes it very hard for them to sort of continue to do a little bit of final work on their paper or run a couple more experiments or whatever. Now they'll be able to do that quite readily using the open source version of TensorFlow. And people will come in perhaps knowing how to express machine learning ideas using TensorFlow. That'll help us a little bit. We're actually in the process of educating lots of Google engineers about machine learning in general and using TensorFlow as the underlying teaching vehicle for some of this stuff.
One of the advantages that Google has is just the amount of talent you have from an AI and machine learning perspective. Your research director, Peter Norving, has estimated that Google has more than 5% of the world's leading experts in machine learning. I'm curious, number one, how Google has become such a magnet for that talent. And the other thing, other side of it, given the fact that this requires a lot of this sits at the intersection of so many different disciplines, computer science, so many other engineering disciplines, neuroscience, biology, mathematics, how you think about the mix of people and skills that you bring together to ensure that you've got the kind of right people in the right seats to advance the cause.
That is one of the really nice things about, partly it's Google as a company has, because we're working in so many areas, we have people with really widely varying different kinds of expertise. And I find that often when you bring together people to work on different problems who have different kinds of expertise they can bring to bear on that problem, you often end up with something that's much better than if you brought a sort of more homogenous group of people with maybe more narrow expertise in one area. And collectively, you end up doing something that none of you could do individually because you each bring different things to the table. So the like our machine learning team is actually a good example. We have people more like myself who have a lot of experience in building large-scale computing systems. And then we have people who are, you know, world-class machine learning researchers. And putting those kinds of people together is actually a pretty powerful combination, because we bring both kind of the systems building expertise and the machine learning research expertise to problems. And as you say, machine learning has gone in the last few years to really touching a lot of different areas. So we're doing some work in, you know, the fields of healthcare and the fields of robotics and a whole bunch of areas of computer science. And that's been really nice. We have several neuroscientists on our team. We're actually starting in a week or two, we're starting a kind of interesting experiment in our group called the Google Brain Residency Program, where we're bringing people to Google to work on our team for a year, basically to learn to do machine learning research. And those people come from lots of different kinds of backgrounds. We had, you know, a tremendous number of applicants for this program. We were able to select, we're going to end up with about 28 people in this program. And the cool thing is they come from very different backgrounds, both in terms of where they are in their career. Some are like just finished their undergraduate program. Some finished their PhD. Some are just finishing a postdoc. Some have been working in various industrial capacities for a while. But they also bring both backgrounds in computer science and statistics and mathematics, and a few people with backgrounds in physics and biology. And I think it's going to be a really nice kind of mix of perspectives on a lot of problems.
I'm curious about the extent to which you speak to and work with other large organizations who are not tech-centric organizations, but rather ones who would be the users of artificial intelligence and machine learning, more traditional companies perhaps than Google. How do you see the adoption curve? And obviously this will be very different company to company, even industry to industry, but there are some leading industries that are starting to, it seems, take advantage of artificial intelligence. I'm thinking of healthcare or financial services organizations that have a tremendous amount of unstructured data that can extract a tremendous amount of value by virtue of making that more structured and getting a faster path towards answers. I'm curious if you've had a chance to interact with companies in those industries or beyond to talk about like what the process is to ramp up artificial intelligence within a more traditional setting.
It's going to be like most companies in other industries are probably not as far along in applying machine learning to their business as Google is, or other sort of tech companies, consumer internet companies. Farthest along in this path, but I think ultimately most companies will adopt more and more machine learning techniques over time, just because, and it's going to be very powerful and transformative for their business. Our group interacts with people outside of Google in various ways. So we've had a number of discussions and have established partnerships with some large healthcare organizations to see what machine learning can do for some kinds of problems in the healthcare domain. And then we've recently launched a cloud machine learning product that allows people to run machine learning algorithms on Google's cloud infrastructure. And as part of that, there are obviously a number of companies interested in, well, what can I use this product for in the context of my business? So I've chatted with, a group of 50 people from different industries, giving them a talk about how we see machine learning, how our progression went from when we started using deep neural nets in 2011 and had almost no people within the company using them to today, where we have hundreds of teams using kinds of techniques. And I think one of the ways that this transition will happen is there's several levels at which you can use AI techniques and machine learning approaches to solving problems. One is for some kinds of domains, like understanding what is in an image, that's going to be generally useful across a lot of industries. And Google and other companies are offering kind of very simple to use interfaces where you don't actually even need to know any machine learning. You can just give an image and say, tell me about that image. And any software engineer can use that without having any machine learning expertise. And they get back information like, oh, that's a picture of a stadium and people playing baseball. And there's a bunch of text in the image, and this is the text. And that's going to be quite useful, even without that person in another company applying machine learning. And then there's going to be models that have already been developed that work well in different domains that you can retrain on that company's data and basically get a customized solution that solves a particular problem, but on that company's data, but without having to do the core machine learning research to actually develop a completely new model. A good example is the sequence-to-sequence work that our group did. We've now applied to 6 or 7 different problems within Google using the same basic model. Another good example is we've done work on essentially a model that takes in an image and finds interesting parts of that image. And that model, general model, has been useful in several different domains. So one is, you know, detecting where text is in Street View images. You want to be able to read all the text, and the first thing you have to do is find it in like storefronts and street signs and so on. And that same general model is also useful for like a healthcare setting, where one of the teams that also works in Google Research has been doing diagnosis of diabetic retinopathy, which is this task where you're given a scanned image of a retina and you want to find other little indicators of a disease called diabetic retinopathy in that scanned image. And that's fundamentally the same problem, although it's totally different domains. And the same model structure works well, and you just point it at different data. Instead of Street View images with text highlighted, you point it at retinal images where a doctor has circled the diseased parts of the retina. And I think that general approach will work pretty well for a lot of different kinds of problems. People will be able to successfully take a model in one domain and apply it to a completely different problem domain.
Interesting. In March, you were present for a portion of the AlphaGo victory in South Korea. And if I've read correctly, I believe you actually were in attendance for at least the first match. And I'm curious, number one, kind of the feeling of having been involved in that and actually witnessing the progress made there firsthand. But I'm also, more generally speaking, curious about your thoughts about these almost World's Fair-style demonstrations of the progress made in AI and the broader impact they have in capturing the imagination of people who might wish to go into the field or just generally developing more curiosity as to what AI could do, the implications or broader implications of AI to people's daily lives.
Yeah, I was there for the first match and a half in Korea, and it was crazy. It was like unbelievable how much excitement there was. 300 million people in China watched the first match on live stream.
The equivalent of our population.
And, yeah, and they had 18 TV channels, each with different pro commentators broadcasting the matches. And Korea had similar levels of excitement. There were like, I think, 4,000 articles published about the first match in the Korean newspapers. And there are definitely not 4,000 Korean newspapers. So it was quite a circus. I think these kind of high profile events actually demonstrate significant progress in various kinds of AI related problems. So most of the AlphaGo work, I should point out, was done by our DeepMind group in London. And we just collaborated with them a little bit on sort of the initial stages of the project. And also they used our machine learning software to train some of the AlphaGo models. And they also used the tensor processing unit, which is this customized machine learning hardware, that chip that Google has designed and gotten fabricated as sort of an additional secret sauce in some sense for that match. And I do think, because people are taking notice of the fact that computers now have these capabilities that they didn't have even as recently as, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, that's causing people to be excited about the field of AI and machine learning. And more people are going to study it. The enrollments in like computer science departments throughout the world in their machine learning classes have been skyrocketing. I think that's generally a healthy, great thing, because this kind of approach is actually going to be not just something that affects computer science, but it's going to affect basically everything in companies and industries, and we'll make a lot of progress as a society the more we're able to, you know, have smart people thinking about these kinds of problems. Just as an example, I gave a talk at my daughter's high school to their STEM club. They have a club of people interested in science, technology, and math. And, you know, there was a lot of excitement about, I have shown some of the recent results people have gotten captioning images and some of the robotics work we've been doing, and people, you know, I think who weren't previously thinking about studying computer science and machine learning, you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. So,
very interesting. Yeah, more people potentially to get involved. There have been a number of very high profile individuals who have been sounding alarms regarding safety concerns related to artificial intelligence. I think of Elon Musk and Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking, just to name a few. As you contemplate progress and are a major force in forging progress on behalf of Google and the many, many members of your team who are involved in that, How do you think about the risks associated with it, and how do you bake that into the plans as you continue to progress the thinking related to artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I guess I'm not a big believer in some of the really doomsday scenarios that some of the people you mentioned are concerned about. I just don't think those are that realistic. I do think that there will be societal change as a result of AI. You know, the biggest one to me is that things that previously were difficult to automate, and so we had, you know, large labor force involvement in different kinds of areas, some of those things will be automated, maybe not completely, but maybe computers will be able to assist in various ways, even fairly high-skilled jobs. Things like reading medical imaging kinds of data have traditionally been very narrow but very high-skilled domains, and I think computers are actually going to be fairly good at that not too far from now. And that, I think, and not to mention, you know, the ability of computers to do automated driving. I'm not sure governments are actually thinking that carefully about the implications of some of these kinds of technologies and what that will mean for society in general. And I think that's what I would think is a more immediate kind of concern, and making sure the policymakers are really thinking carefully about these kinds of issues, I think would be a pretty important step.
Well, Jeff Dean, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT and sharing your perspectives. It's really been a great conversation.
Sure. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.